Hello and welcome to the Botham Richards Cricket Weekly podcast. Before we start today's show, how does he offer a free beer sound? The kind people at Beer 52 are offering a free case of 8 craft beers sourced and curated from the best breweries on the planet. All you need to do is go to beer52.com/wisdom and cover the £5.95 postage fee. Each case is delivered directly to your doorstep, so no need to leave the house. Beer 52 is the world's most popular craft beer discovery club with over 150,000 members that they send a brand new case to every month. Each month's case has a different theme. Past themes have included beer from New Zealand, South Africa, Korea, all over the USA and Europe. As an independent British company, Beer 52 are passionate about the UK craft beer scene and they continue to support it during this difficult period. If dark beer is not your thing, you can simply choose a light option and your case will come through with the award-winning beer magazine Ferment and a tasty snack. Don't worry though, if you do change your mind, you can pause or cancel your account at any time. Just go to beer52.com/wisdom to get your first case of 8 beers for £5.95. Anyway, on with the show. England bowled West Indies out in no time on day 5 in Manchester to regain the Wisden Trophy on a day that saw Stuart Broad become the 7th cricketer to reach 500 test wickets. I'm Yaz Rana and with me to talk through all that and look forward to England's series against Ireland is the managing editor at Wisden.com, Bed Gardner, the magazine editor at Wisden Cricket Monthly, Joe Harmon, and the editor-in-chief of the Wisden Cricket Monthly magazine, Phil Walker. We talked about it a little bit after the second test, but Joe, is this the best Stuart Broad has ever been? He took 6 for 22 on day 3, took his 500th test wicket today, his 3rd career 10 wicket haul. His test average has never been as low as it is at the end of this test match, now under 28. How good is this version of Broad?
It's superb. It's been fantastic since he came back into the side. I guess you would say, in terms of is it the best he's ever bowled, you'd have to add the caveat that this isn't the strongest West Indies batting lineup. And these have been favourable conditions for seam bowling, but he can only bowl out what's put in front of him, and he's done that pretty impressively over the last 2 test matches. And the batting was, I mean, the most fun bit, wasn't it, really? That was extraordinary. And also, it's easy to forget now that England have won by 270 runs, that actually there were a couple of stages in this match where they looked in trouble. Certainly the Pope-Butler partnership on day 1. And then even the next morning when there was that flurry of wickets and Broad smacked his 33 balls, was it? So that was actually more crucial than it will look than it might seem when you look back on the result. It was just one of those games where kind of everything he touched turned to gold. Even at the end, you come on and slings one down the leg side and gets a wicket first ball. Unbelievable effort. And Root was clearly very chuffed for him at the end.
Ben, do you feel that Broad's importance to the team has changed, or at least England are realising how important he is, and do you think that over the next 2 years, looking ahead to the 2 big winter tours in India and Australia, that he is more likely now to be the focus of the plans for that attack than he was just 2 test matches ago?
Yeah, definitely. I think he was kind of slowly edging out of England's overall plans and out of the centre of the team. Not really justly, I guess, looking at the numbers that he had, but he's just thrust himself way back into the centre. Joe's right that it's not the strongest batting lineup, but on that third day, he took 6 for 22. And when you look at the other bowlers between them on show, obviously West Indies one who just gone past 200 wickets, Jason Holt's one of the best bowlers in the world, Shannon Gabriel's as quick as any going. England had Anderson, Archer, Wokes. None of them looked anywhere near as penetrative as he did. And it's got to the stage where he's not just relying on those spells, because that 6 for 22 was spread across 2 innings, and he was just on it straight away from when he picked up the ball. He was absolutely brilliant. And I think the batting point as well as obviously it's nice to see that it's got a bit of form back. Did you see the interview that he gave when he talked about how hard he's been working on it with Peter Moores at Notts, and that he's modelling his game on Shane Warne now, sort of exposing his stumps just so he can kind of swing at the ball?
I saw that. That seems a strange person to model your technique on.
Well, it is, but I guess I guess if you don't have much of a defensive technique to work with, then you've got to find a way to give yourself as many balls as possible to hit almost. It's almost like a kind of a club cricket thing, take a leg stump guard and just swing it and swing everything. But if it helps him get, if he's only ever going to survive 10 balls, it's better he's scoring 20 runs off those than 3 or 4. But the thing that for me that it spoke to is that he's obviously just, he's working so hard to make himself as valuable as possible to the England side, because he knows how important things like that can be, and he also knows that when there's this strength and depth around that you need any sort of kind of cutting edge or take away any other deciding factor there kind of could be. So I think he just seems like a kind of a player refreshed in some ways, not that he was bad before the long break, but he just seems to have kind of like a renewed vigour about him, and yeah, he's going to be around for a long time yet.
You mentioned the batting. You shouldn't underestimate, but we shouldn't underestimate that, because he'd have been so, you see how much pride he has in his game and arrogance coursing in the right direction. He'd have been quite embarrassed by the collapse of his batting, I think, over the last few years. There was a little glimpse of it in Melbourne. Do you remember when he kind of closed his eyes and swung from the hip, and he was clearly still shaking, facing extreme pace? But he managed to get a few away, and I think he might have hit 50-odd, like run a ball 50, albeit on a slow one. Then it happened again in South Africa in the final test match. Was it the final game? When England were 300 for 9, and then Mark Wood made 40, but Broad made 40 as well quite quickly, and they put on 85 and changed complexion of that game as well, in the same way that, as you say, Joe, it changed the complexion of this game just gone as well. If England had been 300 all out, first innings, then it's a different kind of game of cricket. As it was, that crucial hour changed the complexion of it. And it's in his DNA to be a match winner. It's a cliche to describe him as a match winner, but he used to have that with the bat as well. And now it would be peak Broad, wouldn't it? If he somehow flips this around again and becomes a really dangerous number 9-10 in the latter part of his career. And I say that advisedly, because as he's not slow in point, and now he's 4 years younger than Jimmy Anderson, and he's fewer than 100 wickets behind him. He may well just outrun them all.
It's even more important considering that England's lower order runs has actually been quite a big problem recently. That for so long, that was one of England's strengths.
And he became an archetype of the problem, didn't he? Yeah.
And now, I mean, his innings in England's first innings was something that Jofra Archer, for all the hype around his batting before he came in the team, hasn't produced in an England shirt, that Chris Wokes hasn't for 2 years now, and Mark Wood showed good signs in South Africa with the bat. But I mean, Broad, for that innings in South Africa, Broad was batting below Mark Wood in the batting order. You know,
yeah,
that's probably
here,
changed.
43 off 28 balls.
From 11.
From number 11, yeah. And obviously, with Anderson back in the side, he'll bat 10. But that becomes a new threat again, and one that they have been crying out for, really, of late. Obviously, the headline story is the way that he's bowling. They did a kind of triptych of the three stages of Broad's career on Sky, and it was really interesting to see how the action has evolved over the years. And they showed him on his debut 13 years ago, maybe?
Yeah, 2007.
Sri Lanka. And all arms and legs, but he was falling away quite dramatically in the action, and he was slipping away. And you looked at that action and you kind of thought, how can you hold the ball up against the right-hander, really? And then they showed him 2 years on in the 09 Oval game, and he was more upright. And then you saw him now, and the action is the perfect action for a fast bowler of that size and stature. Mm. And he's able now to hold the ball outside off stump. He's able to get that little bit of movement away. And obviously he's lethal, because he's naturally lethal against the right-handers, or of course, famously against the lefties coming around the wicket. He says himself, I bowl better than I've ever bowled before. The evidence is irrefutable. And he looks fit, and he's certainly hungry. Were we on the show last week when I said I'd rather he was opening than Anderson?
That was on the show, yeah.
That was on the show, yeah. I totally stick by that. And yeah, it's a brilliant renaissance, really, for a compelling and ridiculous cricketer.
Ben, what are your thoughts on celebrity appealing?
Was he in trouble for this?
No, he wasn't. He was worried that he might be. And by the letter of the law, perhaps he should be, because you are supposed to appeal for decisions that
by the letter of your dad.
Yeah, yeah, and he definitely didn't appeal when he got Ross and Chase out. He gave quite sort of
that was totally absurd, that celebrity appeal, because it wasn't even that out, and he did a proper fist pump before the umpire had given it. It's a great photo of him with double fist pump before the umpire had raised his finger.
I have to confess, I didn't see this. I read about it. It didn't turn around at all.
It's truly hilarious. Like, it's the most absurd one of the lot.
Is it hilarious, or is it just a bit out of order and disrespectful?
Well, that was the question I kind of had for Ben. I find it funny, but then that one, you do feel, come on.
And that was the one where you could hear on the stunt bike mod of the England players calling it a celebrity appeal as well.
Yeah.
And I mean, from what he said, and obviously you've got to take, you know, the Broad calculates everything he says, so you've got to sort of read between the lines a bit. But he sounded in his press conference like he was almost a little bit embarrassed about it. saying that it's hard to control your reaction when you get a wicket, especially in this instance. He said it was sort of a plan that he'd been working on over three or four overs, that he'd been talking to Chris Wokes at mid-off about coming together. So just when he had beat the inside edge and hit the pad, he was sort of like, that was the release, just that the plan had worked. You can,
and I can see the journalists just nodding their heads somberly. Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. 150 years of Test cricket, and everybody's been able to turn to the umpire and say, "How's that?"
Yeah, I was,
it's hard to control your emotions.
I was thinking about this on the weekend. I was thinking, because I saw the clip of that celebrity appeal just before I went on the field, and I was thinking, "There's no way I could do that." Like it's just instinct to appeal.
Yeah, but especially in club cricket with club umpires, you can never be sure what you're going to get. So if you're just running off towards third man.
And he's all, Stuart Ball's a really nice guy as well. He was helping young Keon Harding in the West Indies out before play, totally unaware of the cameras on him as well.
Do I detect an element of sarcasm?
But elsewhere in the England bowling attack, Chris Wokes had a pretty good game and a pretty good series too. Quietly, has he moved into England's first choice team attack, Joe?
I don't think there is such a thing, and I don't think there can be a thing, really. I think England have got so many options that we've moved beyond that. It's going to be based on fitness, is going to be based on the conditions, and that's just the way it's going to be for the next few years. And I think the England bowlers are all going to have to accept that and kind of put their egos to one side and just accept that's the way it's going to be. I think Wokes is not going to have a problem with that. He's got used to that in his England career so far. But it was kind of classic Wokes, wasn't it? If you were thinking today, who's going to mop up the West Indies? He'd probably be the fourth most likely in most people's minds, with Archer hasn't quite come good in that test yet, and you've got obviously Anson and Broad being brilliant, and then Wokes pitches up with a fifer and does the job as he always does in England. The thing with Wokes, obviously, if we keep talking about the challenges ahead, which I've been reluctant to do, but you know, they've won this series now, so I think it's okay to throw forward a bit, is Wokes hasn't got a very good record away from home, and India and Australia are the two challenges that everyone keeps talking about. So if there is building towards those points, and they are thinking of picking test teams based on those tours, then Wokes will probably naturally slip down the order a bit. Mm. But if you're thinking, we've just got to win this test match in England and pick the best side, then Wokes is going to be there or thereabouts every time. Certainly, you'd have to say ahead of Mark Wood, which maybe we wouldn't have been saying 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago.
Yeah, it's the comparison with Archer that I think is most interesting. Since the Ashes, Wokes has taken 18 wickets at 20 in four tests. I think he did quite well in the two overseas tests in those four. Jofra has taken 12 wickets of 48 since the Ashes. Just in that comparison, I think Wokes is, for me at least, has probably just nudged ahead of Archer.
I think in English conditions, Wokes is at the moment a more effective bowler than Archer. I think Archer only gets a very, very small amount of lateral movement. And if he's not bowling express quick, and there are myriad reasons why that is, as we've covered many times before, the last of which is some spurious notion of his attitude, absolutely. But the reality is that Wokes hits the spot time after time. Now, Archer is an accurate bowler, but Wokes gets a lot more out of a pitch and he gets a lot more lateral movement, and the stats are there to bear that out. Archer is the kind of the Cummins of the English attack, in that if you actually look on paper, the amount, the percentage degree of movement he gets is very slim, as with Cummins. So at the moment, Wokes is probably a more effective bowler day in, day out, I would say, than Jofra. Obviously, Jofra has that extra gear, but we haven't seen that much in this series. There's been other things going on, of course. But they do hunt as a pack, as Joe said. It's now seven test matches since an opposition player made 100, since the second test in New Zealand. That's my own stat.
That's a good stat.
That's a really good stat.
It's my own stat.
Quentin Decott not get 100.
He got 95. Oh. And then Van de Dusen.
See, Ben doesn't trust your stats.
Got 98. No, of course he doesn't. I mean, I barely trust it myself.
So no one has scored a test 100 against England since Mitchell Santner?
Kane Williamson.
Williamson, Taylor,
in the second
and someone
test,
else.
Yeah.
And Latham. Latham got 100 in the second test. Stats. Anyway, the point is that they attack as a pack and they do it well.
Yeah.
That sort of speaks to the wider thing that England's recent form has actually been very, very good. Sort of, if you exclude the first test, which obviously is a ridiculous thing to do, but that's the test that Joe Root didn't captain in. England have now won five tests in a row under Root, and they've all been, I mean, it'd be harsh to criticize England, any aspect of England's play in any of those games hugely, really, especially like Root's just marshalled what have been some quite tough situations in terms of, you know, time limits imposed by weather that might or might not be around, or, you know, an opposition team like really batting hard on the final day. And yeah, he's done a really good job there too, to also marshal those bowlers, which has not often been his strength.
So. It struck me as well, looking down the squad for this three test series, that really everyone's put their hands up at different times. And I don't think you could have said that about many England series recently. They've obviously been very reliant on Stokes at times, who obviously was superb in the second test. But really, you go through the batting lineup and everyone got a score, didn't they? Everyone got a relatively significant score. Butler obviously got his 50 in the final test as well, which will have alleviated a little bit of pressure and kept very well, I thought, in this test. And obviously the bowlers were brilliant. And we're getting to a stage where there is less debate about England's selection, apart from all the fast bowlers that we keep talking about. But that's the selection debate you want to have. There's not really that many spots where we're saying, are they worth their spot on the side? Obviously, that could change within two test matches, but we're in a much stronger position in that sense than we were not very long ago.
Do you think the Root is becoming quite a good test captain? Because we've been reasonably critical of him on this show in the past 12 months or so. But as Ben said, there were some quite difficult conditions, match situations rather, with the weather about, that he actually got England through quite comfortably.
Yeah, it's so difficult with captaincy, isn't it? Because obviously you put first innings runs on the board and it becomes such an easier thing. And you have a pack of informed fast bowlers, and again it becomes so much easier. But second and third test matches, lots of rain around, difficult to negotiate, and he's brave when he needed to be, sticking Stokes and Butler in to open late in the day. I don't think many England captains would have done that. They might have gone one or the other. He went both. Obviously it didn't work with Butler, but it meant the next morning they hit 90 runs in 11 overs and gave themselves enough time to win. And again, the declaration, which was allowed to happen because he scored so quickly in this match, which gave them that little session in which Broad took two wickets. Again, in the end, that they didn't really need that time, although I don't know if it's still raining in Manchester. But they gave themselves as much time as they possibly could to get the result. And I think Root should take a lot of credit for that. It'll be a team decision, but look, when they do badly, the Root, the blame rate lays with the captain. So when they do well, I think it's only fair that he takes the credit.
Do you think it's a one-off that he batted first drop this test match?
I don't think it's a one-off, because I think there is enough flexibility in that team now that Crawley is going to be quite vulnerable depending on conditions, depending on Stokes' fitness. And then Root will just have to step up to three unless they decided to put Pope up there. I mean, I was certainly watching Pope in the first innings.
Brilliant, wasn't he?
After tea, he was just... And it felt like... I mean, he's batting at five in that test, which is fine. But when he's batting like that, I think six is too low, or is going to become too low very quickly. He's so good already that he should be shaping games, not reacting to what's happening.
I tend to agree with you. I think with a rock solid lower order, 7, 8, 9, then I can just about get away with him at six, because you think there's enough time for him to make a score.
Yeah.
But we don't have that, and Wokes' batting has fallen off a cliff a little bit. But yeah, I think the Root thing at three is interesting, because there's overwhelming sense and logic behind it, and I think everybody recognises that, including himself, but he hasn't yet cracked it or shown any real desire to do it. I thought it was one of a number of impressive tactical decisions that he's made in the last couple of weeks, really, that would have been a brave call. It was a selfless call, and I think it does overall reflect a positive sensibility that he does bring to the show. And I can think of many England captains in the past who don't massively like having the job, aren't by nature particularly exuberant or ebullient people, are doing it out of duty. Whereas I think Root brings a kind of, yeah, a positive vibe to the job that reflects in kind of the decisions that he makes. And you listed a number of them just in this series. And the overall thing, of course, do they play for you? Well, they've always played for him, even when he was struggling, even when he was down in the dirt in Australia and so on, and possibly making iffy decisions here and there. There was never any sense that people weren't playing for him. So I think it's probably his team more now than ever before. And you forget how quickly as well time moves on. He's been captaining now for what, 3 years, 4 years?
Three and a bit years, yeah. February 2017. If they beat Pakistan, which is a big if, I mean, Pakistan have usually give England a good contest. What draws the last two series, haven't they? But if they beat Pakistan, that'll be three series wins in a row, which they haven't done since Strauss's team got to number one in the world in 2011. which obviously says a lot about England's inconsistencies in that period, but also shows that they're starting to actually build something quite potentially significant here.
Mm. On route three, I'm a bit conflicted with this, because I think it was the right thing to do in the test match with Stokes on being unable to bowl, and it gave England more options of the ball. But I'm kind of confused. If you can do it for one test, why don't you just do it all the time? Or was that just way too simplistic? Well, because from getting a team together, at the moment, the one spot when Stokes can bowl is available in the team is the number three spot that Crawley is currently occupying. But if Root moves up, then you can have so many more batting options at six, because there aren't that many people scoring runs in the top three. So, like, Lawrence is the guy who's just out of the team at the moment, supposedly, or Joe Denley, and he doesn't bat at three. He's going to have to move out of position at Essex in the Bob Willis Trophy to kind of force his way back in with the current balance, if that makes sense.
But at the moment, Crawley is the man in possession, even though he didn't play in this test match. If they pick a normal top six, Crawley is in that. And it would make more sense for Crawley to bat three and Root four, given that Crawley is, by trade, an opener. So I can see why Root stays at four for now. But I think he's just got to be flexible, and the stubbornness to not want to bat three should be relaxed. But, I mean, it suggests that it is more relaxed if he's prepared to do it in this series decider of a test match. And also, crucially, it went pretty well.
Hmm. Absolutely.
Would you have qualms? Say it was not going to be a long-term thing, but so a series-long thing that they needed a new number three. What would you say if it was Stokes who went there rather than Root, or do you think his bowling's too important?
I think my instinct is that it's a similar question with regards to Root and his captaincy and the mental drain that it takes. We can't imagine. We don't know. I think you can justify... Root can easily justify batting three against the West Indies in these conditions, because you're not going to be in the field for four, five, six sessions. In India, you are going to be. You're going to be facing 650 for seven declared on a certain 2 days. And then you're going to have to go out and bat. If you're Root, then you can understand why he wants the extra buffer of two wickets rather than one. Same, I would argue, probably with Stokes, because he is so central to everything. If in 2 years' time, when Stokes has bowled himself out, and as I said the other week, bowling his cheeky off breaks and nicking them out, then you make a case for it. He obviously has the technique for it. But then you do run the risk of maybe losing the magic of Stokes at five, the game-changing direction that Stokes has. Stokes organises an innings at five, whether it's slow heartbeat or whether he goes for it. He's the pivot around which everyone else seems to work in that inning. So I can understand the logic of him at three, but I wouldn't personally put him at three.
I wouldn't move Stokes. It's just going too well. I don't see that. I think the other obviously big point here with Root three or four is that the main reason is he didn't want to go straight out to bat, but with actually having an opening partnership who don't immediately lose a wicket each time is obviously crucial. So if Root sees Burns and Sibley continue to put opening stands together like they have done, then he's probably going to be more inclined to want to bat or be happy to bat three, given that he's not going to be in the second or third over as he was so frequently when we had a very flaky opening partnership.
I think that's it in a nutshell. I think if England are 50 for naught, whatever the order has gone in to the scorers, if England are 50 for naught, Root's saying, I'm in next. I'm batting next. But invariably, for the couple of years where he has, it was an experiment with him at three, he was in too early. I would like to see it long term. I think a lot of people around the game would like to see it long term. Trevor Bayliss famously was pushing it and pushing it and pushing it. We shall have to wait and see. But the overall point, I guess, is that there is a flexibility and a versatility to this team that we haven't seen in a little while. And there are reserves for every slot who can come in and do a job.
Well, it was a different issue with England's batting order, but you mentioned Butler did bat very well in this test match. And for me, it was interesting that it came at number six, where his record is actually very good. He averages over 40 there, which is one of the best for England this century. And I think that he's such a confusing test cricketer, because you think that with the skill set he has in one day cricket, he can just kind of, you know, come out first ball and start teeing off. But actually, he's essentially just a proper batsman, basically. And that almost the issue with him at number seven is that he's not allowed to do that, and he can't. I feel like it's almost when you're able to hit sixes off basically any ball possibly, then you're not going to be able to shepherd the tail as well, because you think that, like, I could just hit three sixes here and then you end up getting out, rather than someone who is sort of more limited number seven would like be like, well, I'm not going to be able to, I'm going to just take the singles that are on offer, hit a bad ball four, and then you end up, actually end up milking more runs that way. There isn't a space for Butler in the team at number six at the moment. But I think maybe that, for me, that showed the template for him that he should just be a sort of a proper batsman at seven, like try and go out the same mentality, even if he does end up batting with a number 10 or 11.
I found his innings quite strange. So obviously it was really important in terms of the match situation. 122 for four, England could have easily been rolled out for around 200 as they were in the first test. But I think Butler really benefited from West Indies potentially getting their selection wrong. When Butler was an 18, that's when they brought on Cornwall, hold a ball a couple more overs, and Chase came on. And he's a very, very good player of spin. And Rakim Cornwall and Ross and Chase aren't going to worry Josh Butler, basically. And Pope and Butler made hay against those pair of spinners and did very well. And England benefited from it. But I think Butler in particular really benefited from West Indies not playing Al Sara Joseph.
It was a very strange team selection, wasn't it? West Indies won.
Mm.
And then to win the toss and bowl first. When you're playing one and a half spinners, odd all round.
They're just set up for a draw essentially. But even then, it was an odd team selection. And I mean, I don't know. They probably expect a little bit more with the bat from Rakim Cornwall. But it was.
But they got lucky with Gabriel. I mean, it looked like they weren't going to get any overs out of him at all. It could have been even worse. Mm. And that was not really a shock given his fitness issues coming into the series. It was a strange one. That they just clearly didn't trust their batsmen to bat first on pretty much any wicket, which is always going to be a major hindrance.
Mm. Just on West Indies, Joe, as you said, the heavens opened shortly after England sealed victory, and we don't know whether or not there would be more cricket in the day if West Indies bat a bit longer. But they'll be really kicking themselves about the way they lost some of those wickets. The run out of Chase, the wild hook from Hope.
Yeah.
Because they're quite a frustrating team. Their bowling attack's really good, but their batsmen just don't back them up at all. Only Blackwood averaged over 33 for them this series.
Yeah, and I think it was the stat that Holder's the highest ranked batsman, and it what, like 43 or 44 or something?
And he bats eight.
Which says it all. I was listening to Carlos Brathwaite on TMS on the way in, who's fantastic.
Yeah, he's great, isn't he?
It's one of the good things about West Indies series. Ian Bishop's fantastic as well. They do bring some brilliant pundits along. And he was just saying that he just felt like when West Indies ran out of puff, and that is how it looked. But the kind of adrenaline of the first test victory and the high of that, they're obviously kind of buzzing, and it started pretty strongly in the second test as well, but it faded pretty quickly, and the batsmen didn't seem to have enough time to think about what they were doing to be able to fix it. I mean, they were all getting out in quite similar ways, caught on the crease, which was a bit surprising. The message wasn't getting round the change room a bit more, but then you felt like if there'd been a proper break in the series, then maybe those things would have been kind of countered slightly more effectively. But in the end, it's a funny series because you'll look back on this in terms of scorecards and it won't stand out as anything particularly impressive, really. And I don't know if it's because we were just deprived of cricket or any kind of entertainment for so long that this was always going to seem like an excellent series, but I really enjoyed it much more than I thought I would in terms of a contest.
Well, the first test was a classic. That was a great test match. And the second two, England battered West Indies basically, but the rain made it really interesting. All the tension we felt was basically the weather. Having a couple of washouts made it really interesting.
Just on that briefly, Freddie Wilds did a very good tweet, I thought, a day or two ago, saying this last game was simultaneously a good advert for four-day test cricket and for five-day test cricket. Four-day test cricket because you got a result within the 4 days and it ebbed and flowed across the 4 days. 5 days because it bloody rained again. So it was quite a good point, really. In this last game was a bit of an anticlimax, wasn't it? And Brathwaite's bang on. The West Indies invested so much in that first game that they turned up this morning and you could sense it. You could sense it straight away. England only needed 30-odd overs to get it done. But because of the nature of the series, there hasn't been an enormous amount of jeopardy, I've found. And so everyone kind of goes home feeling pretty good about life. The West Indies...
That's what we want, isn't it?
Yeah, it's nice. It's nice. The West Indies go with a head held high. They won a game. They by no means disgrace themselves in any way. And they deserve enormous props, of course, for turning up in the first place with all the challenges facing them. So it's kind of... There is a ceremonial element to the whole series, I thought. And so we don't walk away thinking, oh, well, what could have happened here and there? We walk away thankful that it took place in the first place. I think the next series will be really tight. I think Pakistan will turn up with two or three gun batsmen and a gun pace attack. I think that one can go anyway.
We'll get on to the Pakistan series in a bit, but just on West Indies, Ben, how big a miss was Darren Bravo and Shimon Hetmyer? You add those two guys to that West Indies middle order. I think that makes quite a big difference.
Yeah, and I hope they do go away sort of thinking like, well, it is great that we came over and it's great that we got a win, because they could quite easily sort of feel a bit sore for themselves, given that, because they were just massively targeting this series as an opportunity to catch England cold from like months out. Like they had a much, much more thorough sort of warm-up schedule plan. You know, they were going to come over, they're already going to play a game against their A side and have like a proper training camp in England and then play against like a few counties rather than just like one like trivial warm-up game, and then come into the test series kind of running red hot. And instead they've had to like sit in a hotel. They still played more warm-up games in England, oddly, between themselves, but Bravo and Hetmyer are huge. I mean, you look at their stats recently and their stats in test cricket overall over a recent period of time, and they're not that impressive, but both of them played pretty key parts in the series win last time. And you're right that, I mean, given that West Indies actually, through, you know, no credit of their own, came pretty close to drawing those two test matches, Darren Bravo especially, who's got probably one of the soundest techniques in the Caribbean, maybe probably the most talented batsman they've got. If he bats, you know, 100 balls in both those innings, then they draw those games and win the series rather than just retaining the trophy. So yeah, that's pretty huge. And I think also the other thing is that it's easy to look at the squad at the moment and think like, well, who could West Indies even bring in for Shai Hope? Is he just going to stay in the team by default from now on? But actually, you'd think that Bravo and Hetmyer will be in the team for the next game, and he's going to have to really work hard to win his place back, if indeed he kind of ever does, because he's so important to the ODI team that he's almost not going to get a chance to
keep together a body of work. Keep a bat for me, Shai Hope. We're batting at 6 or 7.
Yeah, but Darwich, I know he struggled this series after the first test, but he has been basically their best batsman for the last couple of years. That would be really harsh to jettison him to get Shai Hope, who just hasn't scored a run in
The look of Josh Silva, didn't they, who got a lot of runs in first class cricket. So yeah, it would even be a struggle for him to get in that position. But he still, even the 30 today before he played a not particularly sensible shot, still played some beautiful shots. He's just one of those players you think probably will come good at some point.
I felt a bit sorry for him today as well, because it was right off the toe. I mean, it looks terrible, obviously. You're trying to save the game. But there's all that space out there, and he got in position quite nicely to play it. Got his hands through it, but he just toed it rather than milled it. I felt a wee bit sorry.
A bit of empathy there for him.
You know, if he'd thrown his hands at a wide one and nicked off the third slip, I think that's actually probably poorer than playing the shot that he played. But anyway, that's my own reason.
I think West Indies will view the series as a massive missed opportunity. And also, I think today they kind of... England bowled very, very attacking lengths, very attacking field, so runs were there for the taking. And I think West Indies almost fell for that a little bit in terms of like they did not bat at all like a team batting for the draw. And just because the runs were there for the taking, they kind of fell for it a little bit. As Phil mentioned, there is a Pakistan series that starts very, very soon. Just on England first, going into that first test of that series, how do you think England will balance their side? Do you think Crawley will come straight back into 11, Ben? Or do you think England will have a similar balance to their side? Could they potentially leave Don Bess out, who didn't bowl at all in the third test, but had a really good run out?
Yeah, I'm going to sit on the fence, but I think for good reason, because like the success of this test match and this lineup basically allows them to just pick based on conditions and weather and all those sorts of things. So I mean, Crawley, the one thing about that is it is sort of unfair on Crawley in his development if he's kind of coming in for a test, going out, coming in again, and you wonder how you can kind of like build a test career in that case. But I think that's kind of just the nature of it at the moment. So they'll come and they'll look at the surface, and if it looks like a real green one and there's some rain around, maybe they'll pick all the bowlers. Or if they want to, you know, they think it's a bit flat, maybe they'll pick a team that can rack up a huge score so they don't lose the game. I think they could easily do any of the things. But yeah, leaving Don Bess out will be will be something that they'll think about, considering this game. It was just a spectator, basically.
Wokes is too high at 7 on current form, isn't he? Against a good Pakistan side, who you'd think would get more runs on the board than West Indies and have a pretty formidable pace attack. I think that's asking for trouble. I think England had to win this final test as well. I think for the first test against Pakistan, that would be a overly aggressive way to go.
And Stokes will be bowling.
And Stokes will be bowling as well, crucially, you'd hope. So yeah, I'd go back to Crawley at three, and then you just have to pick between your seamers, and I'd still always be inclined to pick Vess, have your spinner there.
Agreed.
On the Pakistan side, Pakistan's probably their first choice side was skittled out for 113 in their most recent warm-up game. Sahel Khan, remember him?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. He's 36, hasn't played a test for a while. He took a 5 foot in that, and he took a 5 in their first warm-up game as well.
So who skittled them for a...
So Sahel Khan...
But it was Team Green versus Team White.
Yeah, so it was basically their second team versus their first team.
Was he on Team White or Team
Green? So he was on the... whoever the second team were. Okay. And he took...
I don't know if
took,
I can make an Incredible Hulk joke or anything.
Okay, great. and then... Yeah, so he's got a pretty good chance of playing. They could go in with potentially four seamers. Naseem, Shaheen, Sahel Khan and Mohammed Abbas, which is, quite exciting. Phil, how do you see that test series going?
Hard one. Hard one to call. I just want to see him bat, really. I just want to see the boy.
Who are you talking about?
I just want to see him bat properly in a test match in England. He made 67 and hurt his arm at Lord's, and I was there for that 2 or 3 years ago. I just want to see Babar Azam go and do what he does. I want to see him make 150 every test match, and the result's immaterial. I think anything can happen. I think genuinely Pakistan have got the quicks to shake the series up. You say they might go in four quicks. It's a guess. I don't know, but Selby was saying Yasir Shah. Mike Selby was saying Yasir Shah. Looks like a stick on to play. Don't know if that's true or not, but I would be very surprised if they don't pick the leggy who won the game at Lord's 2 or 3 years ago.
4 years ago now. He's had quite a difficult time in test cricket since. And also, I think Pakistan went in with four seamers in one of their home tests recently as well. So I think it's a realistic chance of that happening.
Is Shadab Khan in the squad? I should know.
He's in the squad. He
got some tap in the first
one. Yeah, he went none for 100 odd at six and over. But it's a warm-up game. No one watched it, so we don't really know how he bowled.
When Pakistan have come over here in previous years, obviously not going back, but in the last 10, 15 years, you've always felt that they're a bit skewed in favour of the bowling rather than the batting. But looking at that lineup now, admittedly their first choice batting lineup was skilled 110 or whatever it was, 113. There are some talents in there that they haven't necessarily boasted in previous tours in recent years. And with Azhar now captaining and batting in the middle order, I believe, and obviously Babar as well, and Shafiq is back in the squad.
Lots of experience in England. This is Azhar Ali's fourth tour of England.
You compare that to the West Indies side, which I know Hope got runs last time, Brathwaite, but a lot of them hadn't played a lot of cricket in England. It's absolutely crucial.
Yeah.
I think Babar Azam is just key, though, isn't he? Like, if he has a brilliant series, the rest can kind of bat around him, but if he doesn't, then you can see it kind of falling apart. He's the one that's properly been in form recently, and the one proper like world class batsman in their lineup at the moment. I know that Shafiq and Azhar Ali have had their good times, but they just haven't had that success recently.
Shaan Masood to open the batting,
yeah.
Presumably, I mean, he obviously did really well over the winter and one of the most improved players in world cricket. Really, really bright man, captaincy material, they say, for down the line. So, you know, he can offer them something. Imamul Haq as well, will he be opening or is he not likely?
Abid Ali, is it?
Yeah, so Abid Ali made his debut recently. I think he's got 200 already.
Yeah, he made hundreds in the Pakistan home series, didn't he? Okay.
He's the only player to get a 100 on ODI and test debut.
There you go. Stats.
This has been a great podcast with stats.
Yeah, absolutely. There's a gap in the side because Harris Sahail, who was in their side for their most recent test, hasn't toured.
Right.
So we don't know who's going to bat six. Heder Ali, who everyone's excited by, is not in their squad. They've released a squad, I think, yesterday or today, and he's not in their 20-man squad. Fawad Alam, who scored 150 on debut years ago, he might play. Or they could just play the extra bowler, pay Shadab at seven with Rizwan with the gloves. Mm-hmm. I think it'll be a really good series, but I think England have such an advantage because they played three tests. They're going to be properly ready, whereas Pakistan have just had a couple of warm-up games at Derby, lowish intensity.
Although Naseem Shah looked like he was kind of hitting his straps quite
he
nicely
looked quite
in
good,
the,
yeah,
the
yeah.
highlights of sort. I mean, that'll be if Naseem Shah up against England's in-form openers will be fascinating to see how that goes. I can't wait to watch it. Phil's looking forward to Babar Azam. I am as well, but Naseem Shah, I think, is going to be great to watch this summer.
I think your point is a really good one, actually. England are now match fit, and that might be crucial, certainly in that first game. We shall see. First one, Old Trafford, and then it's over to Rose Bowl. Sorry. Yeah.
The Aegeus.
For the last two games.
Emirates, Old Trafford as well. Yeah.
Emirates. Sorry, James.
And before the Pakistan series, England play Ireland in a three-match ODI series. From an English point of view, first off, they picked a pretty experienced 14-man squad, rather. They've controversially left out Phil Salt, who scored a 58-ball ton against Ireland for the Lions this week, and Sam Hain, who has the highest List A average of all time. Joe Denley's back in the squad, so if you thought we'd heard and seen the last one this summer, you're wrong. The 14-man squad is Morgan, Moeen, Bairstow, Banton, Billings, Curran, Dawson, Denley, Mahmood, Rashid, Roy, Rhys Hopley is back for the first time in 4 years, James Vince, and David Willey. Considering that England have their test players unavailable, that's a really strong squad. They're not taking Ireland lightly at all.
Yeah, and it's easy to forget just how much batting strength they've got, because this would rank alongside England's best ever one-day batting lineups, and they've got half the players missing. It's a really strong squad. I'm not surprised they haven't just thrown in a load of kids, because there's a lot of players who have been waiting on the fringes for games for a very long time. People like Billings, for instance, who's played bits and pieces, hasn't quite got the record that he'd like at this stage. Big series for him. Big series for Banton as well, who's got a lot of players to get past if he's going to get into that side. But even though this is ODIs, if he can score some 50 over runs, that's really going to boost his case for T20 cricket as well, I think, which is probably his easiest route in for the time being.
Yeah, and it's nice to think they were just like throwing the kids, as they kind of have done against Ireland recently. I'd be interested to see what proportion of England's recent ODI debutants have come against Ireland. Probably quite high, but
depends on your version of interesting.
That is true, but also for the likes of Bairstow and Roy, like, this is like one of the very few kind of almost meaningful England games of cricket they'll get to play this summer, even this year. You know, the opportunities are limited so much more that actually, like, a three-match ODI series against Ireland becomes more important for them in terms of their careers. And the other thing as well is that this series does actually mean something in terms of the ICC Men's Super Cricket League. World Cup Super League, which determines qualification for next time around. And you don't want to start badly, even if you win 2-1 rather than 3-0. You don't want to do that, especially might happen with as a get a few washouts, and all of a sudden you're sort of like playing a little bit of catch up. And I mean, England will want to win it as well, not just squeak into the World Cup. So yeah.
And that Scotland win might be in the back of their minds as well from a few years ago. Mm-hmm.
And the last Ireland game, that was really Ireland. Close.
Yeah, so I mean, yeah. I'm glad they're a bit strong squad.
Yeah, so it's worth talking about the World Cup Super League. So the first seven teams qualify directly to the World Cup. So you really want to be in that first seven teams. Mike Athlon made the point the other day when they're talking about it on Sky that even if you then qualify through the World Cup qualifier, that means you probably have to move around some tours that you've booked in that cost a lot of money. So you really do want to qualify for the World Cup directly through it. And it looks like England are taking them very seriously. Ben, from an Irish point of view, who should we be looking out for?
Well, you still got quite a few of the old guard there that you'll recognise from England-Ireland clashes gone by. Kevin O'Brien is still kicking around, and maybe even better than ever. He's had brilliant T20I form recently. William Porterfield isn't captain, but is still there. Andrew Barberny is the Baba Azam of Irish cricket, I guess, and that he's lovely to watch, and he's
the Rolls Royce of associate cricket, I've heard him described as.
Right,
anymore, but
Niall O'Brien
sounds like something Niall O'Brien would say.
There's definitely some batting potential there, and they'll put up some decent sized scores. I think it's just the bowling against that England batting. Like, there's no Tim Murta now. Boyd Rankin is getting on a bit, although he's obviously still a wily operator, and then there's just quite a lot of youngsters. So it's
alarm bells did go off when England Lions knocked it down in 34.3 overs or whatever it was.
Ireland still did score 300 though.
They did, yeah, but it sort of backs up Ben's point that they might be a bit batting heavy, but we shall see.
Yeah,
it's just great that it's a three match series with something riding on it, as you say. Mm. There'll be criticisms of the supposedly convoluted nature of this new Super League, but I don't see it as problematic, really.
It's not that complicated.
No, and it's not. It was overly complicated on Sky, I thought, the other day. Fundamentally, it brings about more cricket for the so-called emerging nations, and significant cricket, important, substantial cricket, rather than the odd patronised game here and there.
Imagine how amazing it would be if one of our Ireland or Netherlands qualified automatically for the World Cup by finishing seventh. Like, they wouldn't have to go through a qualifier. That would be absolutely amazing.
And also just Netherlands getting 21 like proper ODIs is great as well.
I think it's a great thing. My issue with it is that not everyone plays everyone in the cycle much in the same way as the World Test Championship. So in ODI cricket, that seems quite a problem potentially. I mean, you could have a much easier run if you're not playing some teams than others. So there's an inequity to it, but it's still trying to solve the inequities at large of world cricket. So I think it's got to be a good thing. And, you know, you've just got to work with the schedule that you can.
And weirdly, in this instance, with the schedule they've got this time, the inequity actually works against India and Australia, I think, because they were quite keen to play the big teams. They don't want to play that many three-match series against the likes of Afghanistan or Netherlands. They've got a lot of their series are against the teams who you'd expect to do really well. So they're actually going to have kind of a harder time of it.
Says your tip, India don't qualify for the next...
Well, they're the hosts. Okay.
But it's a fair point, though, because Australia in particular... I'm not saying they won't qualify automatically for the World Cup, but Australia in particular rotate their first choice bowlers loads. And I think it's a reasonable drop off between their first choice 11 and their second choice guys. And it will mean, as England have shown, that you might see less squad rotation, which is an additional challenge, I guess, for the bigger teams.
And more stuff riding on it. You talk of Australia, the start of the Amazon documentary, they'd won something like 4 games in 22. That kind of form gets you out of a World Cup. How beautiful would that be? So, yeah, I'm comfortable with it. I'm pleased that it's taken place. Mm. It's, you know, the ICC needed to do something, I think, to quieten the doubters regarding the whole 10-team World Cup thing. And this is a decent first step, I would say.
We might see Mitchell Starc playing in ODIs, not in World Cups. In 2019, the 10 ODIs he played were only in World Cups. I think that's a good thing.
Can I just, just an Ireland, they obviously do have some promising young players. The one that I really like the look of is Josh Little, who I saw in action in the U19 World Cup a couple of years ago. And at that stage, he was clearly a cut above the other Ireland players on offer, but was really mixing it against, you know, the other sort of fully established sides with fully established youth setups at that point. He's sort of a brisk left armer, took 4 for against England, obviously, last time. Can also hit a long ball. And Harry Tect is the other one that is from a proud cricketing family, but he's one that they really like the look of.
Gareth Delaney's really good too, young batsman. He scored 89. Bats 3, sometimes opens. He bowls a bit of leg spin as well. He scored a really important 89 in the men's T20 World Cup qualifier against Oman, who you might be thinking, oh, but it was Oman. But Oman had one of, if not the strongest attacks in that tournament. And were it not for that innings, Ireland might not have qualified for the T20 World Cup. So he's a really nice young player. So hopefully see a lot of him in the series. The Bob Willis Trophy starts this week, a meaningful first-class competition. The 18 counties have been divided into 3 groups based off their geography, and there'll be a final at Lord's. Obviously, this is great. But Ben, you really like the format.
Yeah, well, I
why'd you laugh?
Just
because you're happy.
Yeah, it's just given me a level of enthusiasm that I didn't expect to
demonstrate.
Exactly. Yeah. I do like the format of 3 groups of 6, with the caveat that I think you'd want to just rejig them slightly from a competition point of view. Looking at it, the North group with Yorkshire, Lancashire, Leicestershire, Durham, Derbyshire, Nottinghamshire feels like Yorkshire, especially, going to have a pretty easy ride. Lancashire as well will fancy getting out of that with not sort of down the dumps a little bit, and the other 3 sort of kind of also rans in general in Div 2 in recent times. Whereas the others, you know, in the central group, you've got Gloucestershire, Somerset, and Warwickshire, who are, you know, all Div 1 teams. Then Worcestershire, you know, the yo-yo county, and then the south group is probably the toughest of the lot when you've got, you know, Essex and Surrey have won obviously the last 3 between them. Kent as well, up and comers. And then Sussex, always going to be tough to beat. Hampshire and Middlesex. Like those are 6 heavy hitting counties. So I don't know how you would do it in general. I mean, I guess in normal years you'd be able to have more travel, I guess, in general would be fine. But yeah, I love the format. I'm really excited to follow it.
So you think it's a format that could last for longer than just this year?
Yeah, so they've been quite keen to stress that obviously this isn't the county championship. This is a new thing. It's a one-off only. But in other competitions and other sports, you've kind of seen these things kind of starting to catch on, like the alterations they've had to sort of develop by necessity. They actually quite like and might stick around. So in Super Rugby, if anyone watches much of that, Super Rugby Aotearoa. So normally Super Rugby is played between a few different teams in a few different countries. So New Zealand, Australia, South Africa, and there's a team from Japan as well. But Super Rugby Aotearoa, which is just the New Zealand competition for this year, has been like absolutely amazing. Like all the games have been thrillers pretty much, and they've sort of thinking like, well, why don't we just do this all the time, and kind of using that as a bit of leverage to kind of get more of their teams into Super Rugby in general when it goes between back in between all the countries. So yeah, I could easily see it sticking. What do you reckon, Phil?
You lost me towards the back end of that otherwise pretty persuasive point that you made, and I do tend to agree with you. I like it. I've, for what it's worth, been advocating three groups of six for quite a few years. In normal times, 10 four-dayers to me is a more appealing package than 16 four-dayers.
14 now.
14, sorry, yeah. You're right, 14. You know, and personally, I would run it to a semi-final that they're there for. In normal times, I would have obviously the three group winners and then the best place runner-up to play probably a couple of four or five-day semi-finals to ensure a result and then a final at Lord's. That's what they're doing this time round, just without the semi-finals. So there is a five-day, I believe it's a five-day final at the at Lord's in early October?
Yeah, finishing.
It needs to be a five-day to get it in.
Yeah, indeed, yeah.
Yeah, with the tournament finishing as late as October 3rd.
Wow.
Potentially.
Yeah, they've done excellently to get this up and running. Speaking to, you know, some big influencers within the English game, even up to just a few weeks ago, and they were saying, no chance of four-day cricket. Rob Key said it to a publication that I was involved in. Michael Vaughan said it to me as well. They thought there would be issues around the furloughing system as much as anything else, let alone the travel, let alone the biosecurity element. The fact that we've got some games of cricket, some proper four-day games of cricket, first class as well. There'll be stuff riding on it. Players will be playing for their teams, but their averages, their own careers, and it's really an excellent feat, I would say, by all the clubs, the ECB overseeing it as well. And as you say, to be able to get a few people through the doors as well is fabulous.
Yes, cricket is at the forefront of the country's fight back against COVID.
This is it. It's always been a forward-thinking and ambitious game, English cricket.
But in all seriousness, it was amazing seeing, or just actually just hearing the ripple of applause for a boundary was really nice.
Yeah, and 2,500 are in then for the Edgbaston and Oval games next week. Incredible stuff, really. And the games will be played in a great spirit, I expect. You know, there will be a sort of a celebratory element to it. And you imagine, I think we said this 3 or 4 months ago, you imagine being a batsman, an opening bat, who's been training now for 9-10 months since you last actually played a competitive game. You're not playing a shot, are you? You're not playing a shot for 4.5 sessions because you're going to value your wicket so profoundly. And it's going to be great. It's going to be great to see, I think. Whatever happens with the result, it will... The results themselves, there'll be curiosities, I think, but the fact that it's taking place is great for the game.
And sorry, just on the format, I like the conference style in particular. You prefer that to three divisions as such.
Yeah, exactly. But it would be interesting to see. I mean, I don't think it's going to make much odds in the immediate term, but I think down the line, the notion of three groups of six has been discussed at high level. And there's some real big people who have been advocating this for a few years. So we've stumbled on this out of necessity and contingency, rather, for this year. But I wouldn't be surprised if sometime down the line it becomes well established. Because as we know, a lot of the smaller clubs, they don't really want to be playing four-day cricket. It's very much a loss leader for a lot of the clubs. And when push comes to shove financially down the line, I wouldn't be surprised if this becomes the norm.
Before we finish today's show, there's a very exciting film that's coming out soon, 501 Not Out, that charts a time leading up to and following Brian Lara's 501 for Warwickshire in 1994. We'll play the trailer now, and following it is a discussion I had earlier with its director, Sam Lockyer.
I still don't think this makes me a great cricketer. I'm still just 24 and got a lot of cricket ahead of me. You know, hopefully when I get to a ripe old age, then I can be talked about as a great cricketer.
That is a magnificent shot.
There's that sort of Caribbean influence in Brian Lara's batting that made him an extravagant, explosive player.
Teams hardly can score 500, let alone one single man.
It's just a pleasure to watch. I mean, he's an unbelievable batsman. He's the best player that I've ever seen.
He was a pioneer of everything, the way he hit the ball, the way he timed the ball.
I loved watching him on TV. He wasn't much fun to bowl to.
Well, he was phenomenal. Brian Lara was one of the greatest players I've ever seen, one of the greatest players that's ever walked on the planet.
The West Indian batsman Brian Lara has rewritten the record books yet again, this time with the highest innings in first-class cricket.
Somebody scoring 501 in an innings, it's unheard of. No other man could have done it than Brian.
497, Lara swings at that, through the covers for four, the cheers from the Mauritius supporters, Lara's bat in the air.
What a player. This guy arrived and I just never seen anyone make batting look so easy.
You're here for one reason, aren't you?
Yep, absolutely.
What is it?
So Lara made the world record.
Big word, BBC Television, tell us why you're here.
439 net outs. Want to say something else?
No, just carry on, sir.
I remember running on and sort of following you and sort of not really knowing what to do with myself once I've got to Lara.
You just wanted to be part of the moment.
And yeah, when he first came to bat to me, he was very small, a large afro. He was just slightly above his thumbs.
He came from being Brian Lara, the test batsman, to Brian Lara, probably one of the greatest batsmen in the world, you know, in the space of a month.
You know, we can look to him as a leader.
The immediate sort of birth, if you like, of a genuine sporting superstar.
And he was a superstar. He looked the superstar, you know, he was cool, how he moved. You know, he just knew this guy was something special.
So Sam, thanks for joining the show. First up, tell us about the film and what inspired you to make it.
Right, thanks Yaz. Yeah, it's lovely to join you. So 501 Not Out, it's a feature documentary all about Brian Lara, who for me is the greatest cricketer that's ever lived. And in particular, the film, as the title suggests, tells the story of his first class world record that he got for Warwickshire at Edgbaston in 1994. So for me, it's quite a personal journey making the film, in that I grew up in the 90s, a massive cricket fan, and Brian Lara was my childhood hero growing up. For me to make this film has been an absolute privilege, an absolute honour. I can't wait for people to see it on the big screen.
So does the film specifically chart Lara's time at Warwickshire, or is it just about the 501 Not Out and then the aftermath of it?
Yeah, so the film really tells the story of Lara's ascent to greatness in 1994. So kind of that kind of 6-week period from when he broke the world test record. He broke Sir Gary Sober's long-standing test record in Antigua for the West Indies, and then he moved to Warwickshire and then had an incredible season in 94 at Warwickshire, smashed all of the records, culminating in the 501 first class world record. So that's the kind of narrative arc of the film. But as a big fan myself, I was keen to kind of go over to Trinidad and trace kind of Brian's roots going up in the Santa Cruz Valley. We managed to track down Brian's, one of his sort of school coaches, Harry Randas, that taught him cricket at Fatima College. So that was an absolute thrill, absolute joy to meet Harry. Lovely, lovely guy. And everyone we met in Trinidad were brilliant. Everyone was so up for talking to us. They were so friendly, and we shot some incredible interviews. I hope that gives you a bit of a flavour. We do touch kind of briefly on sort of Brian's legacy, kind of after the 501, and his kind of, as I said before, his kind of rise to global superstardom and his kind of impact off the pitch as well. So. You know, things like the Brian Lara cricket video game series, which was absolutely massive. I think Brian was one of the first cricketers to kind of be associated with a video game, and there was also the Jeans sponsorship with Joe Bloggs. And yeah, he became this kind of global icon that was kind of bigger than cricket. And again, that was kind of something that was really important for me to kind of touch on in the film as well.
So you're a Warwickshire fan, right?
Yes, I am. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Well,
I think I find it quite surprising how young Lara was in 1994 to achieve all that. I think he was only 24. When Lara came, what was it like as a Warwickshire fan having Lara at Warwickshire? I mean, did you realise how good he was when he first came? And then he kind of developed into this, as you say, global superstar in that time.
Yeah, I think Warwickshire got a bit of a deal with Brian. They actually signed him just before he broke the world record. So that was a good bit of business for the guys at Edgbaston. I imagine when he was scoring all those runs for the West Indies against England, I imagine they thought, oh, hang on, we've got something really, really special. But obviously he scored the 277 against Sydney before that. He was a brilliant player, you know, already at that point. But I think that 1994 season really kind of catapulted him to this, like, you know, hugely, you know, successful, hugely incredible cricketer, and really elevated him to one of the greatest, you know, arguably I'd say the greatest cricketer that's ever lived. Naturally, I'm a bit biased, but yeah, I mean, I actually grew up in Essex, so at that time I wasn't actually a Warwickshire fan at that moment, but I moved up to Birmingham for university in 2002, and then that's when I kind of started following the Bears. But my dad used to take me to Essex matches, so the county ground in Chelmsford, and I remember in the summer of 95 the West Indies were over touring at that point, and I actually remember queuing for Brian's autograph as a child on the boundary's edge, and just being completely in awe of him, you know, the high back lift, the calypso flair, just how entertaining he was. You know, he always had a smile on his face and just went out and just took it to the bowlers, and, you know, would hit these incredible sixes, you know, these incredible fours. He could always find the gaps, you know, in the field. That's really struck me. And I guess I was just kind of quite inspired, you know, by him, really, and everything that he was achieving. So it wasn't until, as I say, I moved to Birmingham a bit later when I'd always had a love of Edgbaston. I mean, Edgbaston's an iconic stadium. I remember being there in 2005 for the Ashes, and I saw all the iconography around Edgbaston, you know, the shots of Brian, you know, in front of the scoreboard. The 501 there is a massive piece of Warwickshire history. Obviously, it's a huge, you know, it's a world record. I don't see that record ever getting beaten, you know. But from a Warwickshire perspective, yeah, I think the club knew they were onto something special. But when, after those first few innings, he was scoring, you know, back-to-back hundreds, I think they thought, yeah, we've got something really, really special here. And obviously they ended up winning the treble that season, and Brian was a massive, massive part of that.
I've often thought that there aren't enough cricket films, so I kind of look across at football, and there are multiple films about each of football's most iconic players. But in cricket, there aren't. You don't really have it. Were there major challenges and stumbling blocks into making the film?
That's a really good question. I think for me, I was quite surprised that there hadn't been a film of a feature documentary for the cinema, a theatrical release. As far as I was aware, there hadn't been one made on Brian Lara before. So for me, I was like, well, I've just got to make this film. I've got to do it. But yeah, it was a challenge to get it kind of, you know, off the ground. And we actually ran a crowdfunding campaign on Indiegogo. And that was really well supported all around the world. We had fans from all around the world pledging small amounts of money. Some would pledge larger amounts. And that helped us kind of get things going. And then we also were very lucky in that Warwickshire came on board and actually helped us as a supporter with kind of in-kind support and access to people like Ian Bell. We interviewed Ian, who was absolutely brilliant. Warwickshire also put us on to Curtly Ambrose's agent, a guy called Rich Sydenham, really, really nice guy. And again, I think Curtly was the first person I interviewed for the film, you know, and that was incredible. You know, Curtly Ambrose, what a legend. So then a bit further down the line, one of our clients, Marston's Brewery, came on board as a headline sponsor, and again that enabled us to move things forward. So it was a long process. It was probably, I'd say, three or four years in the making. But yeah, as an independent film, it wasn't like anybody had commissioned us and said, you know, Sam, go and make this film. It was an independent film that I wanted to make, so it was a case of kind of driving it forward that way. And yeah, I'm just incredibly grateful for the sponsorship from Marston's, The support we had at Warwickshire, and yeah, the crowdfunders, we couldn't have done it without the crowdfunders as well.
I'm sure a lot of people who've listened to the trailer, they can watch the trailer, by the way, on our social channels and 501 Not Out on Twitter and Facebook. But a lot of people who have watched it and heard it are really excited about it. So Sam, how do people watch it? What can they expect?
So where can people see the film? So we premiered it in Birmingham in 2019 at the Midlands Arts Centre. That's a cinema across the road from Edgbaston Cricket Ground, and it sold out. It did really, really well. We then had a screening at Edgbaston Cricket Ground as well, and then another one at the Queen's Film Theatre in Belfast, which is the leading independent cinema in Northern Ireland. And again, that was really, really well received. Kind of fast forward to where we are now. We actually had a UK Q&A cinema tour kind of in the pipeline for this summer, which was going to tie in with the original West Indies tour in June. But obviously due to COVID-19, that's now on hold. But we're looking to pick that up as soon as it's safe. We've got plans for the film to go out into cinemas in the UK, and we can't wait for that. During the lockdown, it's been interesting because there's been quite a lot of interest in the film and people sort of saying, when's it going to be released? When can we see it? So, the UK cinema tour is definitely going to happen. We've got some really, really exciting news. I can't really say too much about it right now, but in terms of a really quite famous, prestigious festival where the film is going to be screened. I can't really say anything more than that. But again, in August, we'll release further information about that. We're also planning some international screenings as well in the Caribbean with Cricket West Indies. They've been very supportive of the film, which is great. And we're also looking into a digital release. Again, hopefully a global release. But again, we're just working out which platform would be the best option for that. It's a really exciting time. I would say if anyone is interested in keeping up to date on where things are at, we'll obviously share updates with you guys at Wisden, and we're so grateful for the support that we've had at Wisden. People can access the Twitter, which is at 501 Not Out, or the Facebook page again at 501 Not Out, and that we kind of share updates on there and clips and behind the scenes bits and pieces and stuff. So yeah, that's a good starting point, I'd say.
You can head to 501notout.com for more info on the film. Ben, Phil and Joe, thanks a lot. We'll be back soon. This has been the Wisden Cricket Weekly Podcast. If you enjoy the show, tell your friends, leave us friendly reviews on the podcast app of your choice, and we'll see you next time.